Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sports are a $73 billion industry in the United States. For many of us, the teams we cheer for are an important part of our identity. We love to see athletes push themselves to the limit, and a lot of us love to push ourselves. This hour, Game Time, sports stories told to a live audience at Merge in downtown Iowa City on November 15th. The event was sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and I kicked off the evening with a sports story of my own. It was my second season as a coach for Girls on the Run. And if you're not familiar with Girls on the Run, it's a social and emotional development program for girls that involves running as well. Also, it's a whole lot of fun. It culminates with a 5K at the end of a 10-week season. So this was my second season of coaching. And my daughter was on my team. She was in third grade. And there was a girl in her class who was fairly new to the school. And I'm going to call her Maria. And she had made friends with my daughter, but as I observed things at school, she wasn't really fitting in. She wasn't making connections. She wasn't doing great. So I schemed with my daughter to recruit her for our Spring Girls on the Run team. And my daughter was all on board. So she did a fantastic job. And she had never done, Maria had never done an athletic event of any kind before, so that was scary to her. She had never done an after-school activity or any kind of extracurricular, so all of that was a little overwhelming, but we got her convinced that she wanted to do it, and then there was a financial barrier, but with Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa, that's not a big deal either because they have never said no to a scholarship request, so we got that cleared away, and then there was one more barrier, and that's that she had no way to get home after practice because she's a bus kid. And with Girls on the Run, coaches are not allowed for liability reasons to give the girls on their team a ride. But because she's friends with my daughter, we worked it out. Her mom had to sign a waiver, but I gave her a ride home after practice. And I was very excited about having this girl on my team. And I tend to be something of an incurable optimist. So this was kind of a project for me. And I knew she was nervous about the running, but she overcame that really quickly because at Girls on the Run, there's not a lot of pressure on the running. We keep it pretty low key and fun. But the thing that she had a hard time with that really surprised me was we create sort of a relentlessly positive environment at Girls on the Run practice, and she had a hard time with that. This girl at 8 years old was so insecure and had such a negative self-image. She didn't think she was intelligent. She didn't think she was likable. She had a negative body image. And she couldn't accept a compliment. Anytime you'd say something nice to her, she just would fight you on it. And she wasn't really connecting with the other girls at practice and I could see the anxiety for her. And we do this lesson about positive self-talk. And one of my favorite parts about it is that I always had the girls, when they'd finish a lap, they would shout something awesome about themselves. So it's really fun because you have these just amazing, beautiful, vibrant, creative, fantastic girls running laps. And after they'd finish a lap, you know, they'd shout, "I am creative! I am kind! I am a good friend!" It's the best thing ever. And she couldn't think of anything to say. And so I would tell her something true about herself, and she'd kind of, "I am kind," you know, mutter it and keep going. And as a Girls on the Run coach, I coached for 8 seasons. And I promise you that as a coach, every single season, there's at least one day where I think, why am I doing this? You know, why am I changing clothes in the bathroom stall at work and then dashing across town and handing out snacks and what even am I accomplishing here? And there are always a couple kids where I'm like, I'm not connecting with them. I don't know if they're getting anything out of the program. And sometimes I leave the season feeling that way. Maybe 2% of the kids I feel like this didn't do much for. But this girl, you know, she was my project. She was so hungry for love and acceptance, and I have so much of those things to give, and I thought that she would just blossom. And I could see over the weeks, I could see her confidence growing a little bit, and she was very proud of the physical accomplishments. She had run farther than anybody in her family had ever run, and she was really proud of that. But still, she could not take a compliment, and it just broke my heart. And it was finally the last day of practice. We had a party. We handed out awards. We made tutus. And I was driving her home, and she was talking with my daughter about how sad she was that the season was ending and how nervous she was about the 5K that was coming up that weekend. And we get to her house, and I jump out of the car to say goodbye, and she gives me a huge hug. And as we pull away, I look her in the eye, and I say, Maria, you are awesome. And she met my gaze, which was new, and she said, I know. And she went to the door. So that is my greatest athletic triumph. Now I think we have some more traditional athletic triumphs, and maybe not. We'll find out coming up tonight. But I want to introduce our first storyteller of the night, Dan Matheson. We've got a little Cyclone-Hawkeye dynamic going on here. Dan Matheson grew up in Iowa City, graduated from Iowa State University, and then came back. He's director of the University of Iowa Sport and Recreation Management Program and an associate professor of instruction. Dan, welcome.
I am not one of the incredible athletes that Charity promised you, but they are soon to come, don't worry. This story involves George Steinbrenner, my first trip to New York, a Japanese baseball pitcher, and the movie Hoosiers. It's obvious where I'm going with this, right? You've heard this one before. So in 1996, I graduated from law school, and I went to work for the New York Yankees in baseball operations. But I actually lived and worked in Tampa, Florida. The Yankees had many of their operations down there, and our owner, George Steinbrenner, lived in Tampa. And when I joined the Yankees, the organization was pursuing a Japanese baseball pitcher named Hideki Irabu. Irabu was a superstar in Japan. He had a fastball in the upper 90s, and every Major League Baseball team wanted to sign him. And he wanted to pitch for the Yankees. Unfortunately, at that time, the agreement between Major League Baseball and Japanese baseball prevented players from choosing which team they would sign with. So Irabu's team in Japan had negotiated a deal to sell his rights to the San Diego Padres. At that point, most Major League Baseball owners would admit defeat, but George Steinbrenner was unlike any other Major League Baseball owner, as those of you who are my age remember. George, he made a career out of pushing back against Major League Baseball's rules and breaking the rules at times. George sued Major League Baseball. He was suspended by Major League Baseball as an owner for almost 5 years. George loved a good fight. And when Major League Baseball told him that he couldn't sign the best pitcher in Japan, this was just another battle that he was prepared to do with MLB. So that's what brings me to my first trip to New York. George scheduled a hearing with Major League Baseball where we were going to present our case as to why the Yankees should be able to sign Hideki Irabu. And George was going to take me and three of his top baseball executives to New York on his private plane from Tampa to attend this hearing. Now, I had only been with the Yankees for a few months at this point. But that was more than enough time for me to become acquainted with George Steinbrenner's legendary temper. I was once in a meeting with George in a conference room with about six other people, and he ripped an office phone off the desk and chucked it in against the wall, shattering it because he was having trouble dialing an outside line. Natural reaction, right? George hired and fired Billy Martin, his manager, five times during Billy's career with the Yankees. And if there's one story that's my favorite for capturing George's, the essence of George's temper, it was told to me by his drivers in New York. They told me that they were driving George in New York and they went through a tunnel and George lost his cell phone signal in the tunnel. And he got so mad, he made them pull the car off the road so he could get out of the car and wedge his cell phone under one of the tires so that they could drive over his cell phone. George had a world-class temper, if you haven't gotten the picture by now. And as ornery as I describe him, I love the man and had a great relationship with him. And I miss him to this day. But as me and my colleagues were preparing to head to the airport to board a small aircraft with George to go to New York, we were prepared for the worst because you never knew what version of George you were going to get on any given day. Fortunately, when we got to the airport on that day, George seemed to be in pretty good spirits. And during the flight, somehow we got on the topic of the movie Hoosiers. And I came to discover that Hoosiers was one of George's favorite movies of all time. And I had never seen the movie at that time. When George found out that I hadn't seen Hoosiers, he yelled, "What?" Just like you would expect his character in Seinfeld to do. And he screamed up to his pilots, "I want a copy of the movie Hoosiers on this flight for the return trip." So things were going great. We had a good flight to New York. George was in a good mood. When we got to New York, we were supposed to be joined by another member of the team that was going to be representing us at MLB.
Storyteller Dan Matheson, director of the University of Iowa Sport and Recreation Management Program and an associate professor of instruction. He also used to work for the New York Yankees. We will hear the rest of his story after this break. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Game Time. We are listening to sports stories told in front of a live audience at Merge in downtown Iowa City on November 15th. The event was put together by Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. And let's pick up with storyteller Dan Matheson, who used to work for the New York Yankees. When we left off, he had just flown to New York City with an optimistic George Steinbrenner, who had just promised that they would all watch his favorite movie, Hoosiers, on the way home. The Yankees were hoping to jump through some legal hoops to be able to sign high-profile Japanese pitcher Hideki Irabu.
George had told our general counsel to hire the best lawyer money could buy to represent us at this hearing. And he did get the best lawyer money could buy. We had a world-class litigator, a real superstar in the legal community, was going to be representing us at MLB's offices. The problem was we barely saw the guy while we were there until about an hour before we were supposed to be at the MLB offices. This lawyer finally came strolling in. He had a sweater draped around his neck and kind of relaxed, looked like he'd just come from the country club. And he sat down with his young associates and they briefed him for about 45 minutes on the arguments that we had been preparing for 2 days leading up to this. And then it was time to go. We had to get to Major League Baseball's offices. So at that point, I was starting to get a little bit worried. How is this guy going to stroll in here and pick up on the nuances of the business of baseball and and make these arguments for us on our behalf after we've been working on it for 2 days. But this guy was a legend in the legal world, and so I was prepared to go. Who am I to question his process? When we got to MLB, the American League president was presiding over the hearing, and the lawyer representing us very eloquently delivered the arguments. The only problem was that the American League president was pushing back against some of those arguments and asking questions. And with only 45 minutes to prepare, this lawyer really didn't have anything to fall back on. And as I'm watching this process unfold, I'm keeping an eye on George and what's happening with him in the room. And his temperature is rising. Oh, he is getting fired up. And at one point, the American League president takes a break and leaves the room. And George spins around to look at our general counsel who hired this lawyer. And through clenched teeth, he snarls at him, "So this is the best you could do?" He was furious. Obviously, with the way that I'm explaining this, we didn't get the player. But that is not the end of this story. So Irabu, as I said, he wanted to pitch for the Yankees. And he insisted that the only team he was going to pitch for was the New York Yankees, regardless of whether the Padres held his rights. So he ultimately forced the Padres to negotiate a trade with the Yankees, and we ultimately got the player that George so desired. And Irabu made his debut at Yankee Stadium the next season, and it was everything that George had hoped for. Irabu pitched exceptionally well. It was a packed Yankee Stadium audience, and there were hundreds of media members there. And in Japan, tens of millions of viewers tuned in to watch the game. That George was delighted. Unfortunately, from that point on, Irabu's career with the Yankees was quite disappointing. Very inconsistent. His effort was often questioned, and he just never flourished into the pitcher that George and our organization thought that we were getting when we worked so hard to get him. But my favorite part of this whole story is what happened after we left Major League Baseball's offices at the end of that hearing. You might imagine we were on our way to the airport, me and my colleagues, terrified. We had just left a very disappointing meeting at MLB. George did not get the player that he wanted. The high-priced lawyer that he was paying for did not deliver. We were prepared to sit on that plane for 3 hours and just get ripped into. But the movie Hoosiers was waiting for us on that plane. And George had his favorite movie to watch. He had me there who had never seen it before, so he narrated the whole thing to me. And the movie Hoosiers now is one of my favorites also, because that movie saved our butts on that trip. Thank you.
Storyteller Dan Matheson, director of the University of Iowa Sport and Recreation Management Program and an associate professor of instruction. Next up, storyteller Ugo Wigwe. She was a basketball star at Temple University. After college, she played pro ball all over the world, and she played for the Nigerian National Basketball League for 3 summers. She's now the director of operations for the Iowa women's basketball team.
Close to New Year's Day, I got an email from the Nigerian Basketball Federation asking if I'd be interested in playing for them that summer. And I wasn't really interested in playing overseas at all. I was actually heading to law school. I had taken my LSAT. I was doing really well in my senior season at Temple. I was sixth man, just doing incredible things. And I was just ready to like move away from basketball. I just thought that chapter was closing. And then out of nowhere, the national team reaches out, and I was like, okay, like I'd like to try it. Although my mind was still with Temple, I just wanted to finish strong. I wanted us to make the tournament. I was actually really excited about the opportunity to play for a national team. My parents were born and raised in Nigeria, and me and my siblings were born and raised in Long Island, New York. So the ability to just represent my family and my ancestors and my roots was really exciting to me. So I graduate from Temple, and a week later I get my flight information to travel to Nigeria to play for the national team. And it wasn't my first time in Nigeria. I've been there plenty of times, but it was my first time by myself. And throughout the entire process, from when they reached out to me to when I flew out there, my dad just did not believe that a Nigerian national team for women existed, like, at all. And he lived in Nigeria for like 20 something years before immigrating to the United States. So funny thing is, he actually left like a couple days before I did to make sure that when I arrived, that there was a coach, that there were players, that there was a bus, that there was a hotel. So I arrived in Nigeria, and there's my dad in the waiting area, making sure that like everything was supposed to be okay. A lot of the players on the Nigerian national team, they're Nigerian Americans like me. We were all born in the States. Our parents had immigrated, and all these girls were professional basketball players. They were playing in England, Spain, Germany, Belgium, in the WNBA, played for a Nigerian team prior. So there I am, listening to all their stories about playing overseas. And I'm just like, wait, hold up. Like, you have Nigerian parents too. Like, how come you're allowed to do this? Like, my parents would never, like being a Nigerian child, like, your professions are doctor, lawyer, engineer, pharmacist, like, really, really high professional jobs. And there I am. There I am, I don't think I want to go to law school anymore. You know, I think I want to play basketball. So I was like, well, if they can do it, I can do it too. Like, I'm gonna, you know, fight my parents on this, even though, you know, I've always been the opposite of my siblings. I do what I want. I don't listen. So that year I got a contract to play in Spain, played in Spain my first year. And, then I got the Nigerian team reached out to me again. They're like, hey, we want you to come try out. This year we're doing the AfroBasket. And AfroBasket, it's a continental competition. So you have a competition in Africa, then you have a competition in America, you have a competition in Europe, you have a competition for the Asian countries. And the top teams qualify for the tournament the next summer, which is the World Cup. So that summer I made the team again, and we went 8-0, defeating Egypt, Mozambique, Senegal, South Africa, all these really, 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 really good basketball countries, and won the national championship. So the fact that I can say I'm a national champion is like really, really incredible. So I remember coming home, flying back to New York, and everyone knew that I had won a national championship because there my parents are with their poster of my face saying, congrats, champion. I was just so headstrong. I was like, I'm going to make this team again. I'm going to make this team again. I'm going to make this team again. There was nothing that was going to stop me. And I got back from Portugal. So now it's 2018. I get back from Portugal in April. And I don't even give myself a break. I'm like, okay, Ugo, like, you gotta like keep working, because you know you won the national championship last year. Everybody and their mom is gonna try to make the championship this year, the team this year. So I, you know, driving from one place to another, working out, I'm changing my diet, I'm like watching all these film on myself, and get a phone call like, hey, we want you to come try out for the national team again. I was like, okay, cool. So the camp's in Atlanta, and I'm the first one downstairs to eat breakfast. I'm the first one on the floor. I'm the last one off the floor. I'm the last one on the bus. I'm super coachable. I'm a great teammate. I'm practicing before practice, practicing after practice. I'm like super confident. Like, I'm like, there's no way I'm not going to make this team. Like, I'm a national champion. I was on a team last year. I'm the best post player. All around, I just felt like I was just like probably the prime of my basketball career. So it's the day before we leave for Nigeria. And if you make it to Nigeria, you basically made the team, because there's no way they're going to send you to Nigeria to send you back home. That's a lot of money. And so like, I'm just like downstairs, like eating breakfast by myself, which is normal because like, I'm just very disciplined and I just want to be the first for everything. And I am eating my breakfast and I get a text message and it's like, hey, can you come to my room? And it's from our general manager. And I just start crying. I just start immediately crying, and I'm just like, well, when people get text messages like this, this means they got cut. So I knock on the GM's door, and she like looks very sad, and like she's like, she doesn't want to say what she needs to say to me. And like, I'm still crying, I'm still hyperventilating. I'm sitting in her room, and she's just saying like, hey, like, I don't know what happened. Everyone told me that you did great this summer. I'm just relaying the message, like, you didn't make the team. And I didn't ask any questions. She didn't give me any answers, because if I didn't make the team, if she gave me answers, I wouldn't be here right now, because I wouldn't have a story to tell. To this minute, to this very second, I have no idea why I got cut. I didn't have a plan B. So I'm waiting for my flight home, and I end up in New York, and this time, no signs, no balloons, no nothing. I just see my dad by his car, and like his arms are just like open, and I just go into it, and I just fall, like I'm heavy. And like I just know for like 3-4 days, like I'm not eating, I'm sleeping a lot, I'm not talking to anybody, I'm not returning any phone calls. My college temple coaches are reaching out to me, I'm not responding. My best friends are reaching out, I'm not responding. I don't know how I pull myself out of it. I don't remember, but eventually I do. And I end up returning my coach's phone calls, and I'm like, hey, I think I want to get into coaching. I don't want to play basketball anymore. Like, I'm not in love with the game the way I was before. There's nothing that's motivating me to get on the court. I don't want to lift. I don't want to run. I don't want to do anything that involves me being physical basketball. But I still want to be around the game. I've been told I'd be a really great coach. So I'll do that. So they're like, hey, it's August, so you're not going to get the best job because it's preseason now. Like, everyone has been hired. And I'm like, I'll take whatever I can get. I just kind of got to get away from where I'm at right now. So I don't know where I applied to. I applied to everywhere. I didn't care where I was going. Maybe a couple of hours after I applied to like 20 places, I get a phone call. And I look at my phone, and it's like number, whatever. And then it's like Iowa. And in my head, I'm like, when have I ever seen those words in my life before? When have I ever said the word Iowa? Like, I remember maybe in like eighth grade, when I was eight, I did a project on Gene Wilder. And that, like, you know, like, I don't remember, like, Iowa and me, like, I just never, it wasn't just something I thought about or said. So I almost didn't answer. But I was like, okay, just like answer. So like the guy says like, hey, like, this is Frank Howell. I'm the head coach at Graceland University. And I'm like, okay, like, he's like, Lamoni, Iowa. I was like, did I apply here? Like, I really don't remember. But I was just hearing him out. And just like long, that whole conversation short, like, I just like literally opened up to him. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know like what he was about. All I know, he saw my resume. He saw my cover letter and he wanted to hire me right away. We were on the phone for about 40 to 45 minutes, and I honestly thought I was talking to my best friend, and he hired me right away. And I call him my white dad because, like, he's just like an incredible, incredible person. And so he hires me, and my parents come home. I'm like, hey guys, I'm moving to Iowa. And they're like, where? And I'm moving. Like, I'm just gonna get my stuff. I start packing, I look for an apartment. And they're like, okay, if this is what you wanna do, like, you know, we trust you. You always make good decisions. Like, if you want to move to Iowa and you trust this guy and you think you're going to do well, like, go ahead. So I get on a flight. I'm going to Iowa. I arrive in Des Moines. Coach Howell comes and picks me up. And I immediately feel a burden lifted off from my shoulders. Like, I'm not depressed anymore. I'm not sad. I'm like, okay, he hired me to be a coach. He hired me to inspire these girls. That's exactly what I'm gonna do. Like, I can't focus on what happened this summer. I have a new direction. So now it's April, season's over. I go to the Final Four to connect and celebrate like the end of the season. And I get a couple of phone calls, like Harvard wants me to come work for them. Temple wants me to come work for them. NYU wants me to come work for them. They're just hearing like how like inspiring I am. Then I get a phone call from Lisa Bluter from University of Iowa. And I'm just like, no way. Like, no way she wants me to come work for her. She says like, hey, like, there's a spot open. Like, I actually came to watch their practice because I had time. And I guess I left a really good impression. So she calls, leaves a voicemail asking me if I'd be interested in a position. Of course, I'd have to go through the whole application process. And they were considering other people. But she would want me to apply. So I apply. I get the job. And all less than a year of me getting cut from the national team. And it's just really funny to me how something that I was so focused on, something that I really wanted, was stolen from me. But honest to God, God had something better planned for me, because like, I'm way ahead of my friends. Like, I'm doing things that people haven't done. I'm the youngest in my position in the country. I'm working for the 16th winningest coach in NCAA. They made the Elite Eight last year. She was coach of the year. She had the player of the year. I'm working for a great staff. My parents are great. My friends are great. I fell in love. I have a boyfriend now. So like, you know, it's just crazy how things go full circle. I feel better. Like my heart's not broken anymore because of what happened. I'm able to talk about it without crying. I'm able to tell the story and inspire others, like especially athletes. And that's how I ended up in Iowa. Like it's weird. It's really weird. But like I'm better for it, and my parents always tell me like they're just so proud that I was able to pick up myself out of that, and I don't think I would have ever done that if I stayed in New York, and I like Iowa, I really like Iowa, and people think I'm crazy for saying it, but I love it, and I think it not necessarily saved my life, but it really picked me up. It picked me up with just a phone call from a man named Frank Howe, who I love very dearly. And, you know, now I work in a Power Five school at a Big Ten school for one of the best programs in the nation. And I couldn't be any happier. So, yeah, that's it.
Storyteller Ugo Wigwe. She is the director of operations for the Iowa women's basketball team. And we have more stories to come as game time continues on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, game time. We're listening to sports stories told to a live audience at Merge in downtown Iowa City on November 15th. The event was put together by Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. And we've got two more stories to go. Next up, Mitch Kelly. He's a clinical associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Iowa. He also serves as the faculty representative for football recruiting. He's a graduate of the U of I, and in his wrestling career, he earned 4 NCAA Division I wrestling championship rings. But his life didn't get off to an easy start. He grew up poor in Dubuque, and after high school, he hitchhiked the 85 miles from Dubuque to Iowa City with a dream of wrestling for the Hawkeyes.
I guess my wrestling story, and it's really my life story, starts back in Dubuque, is where I grew up. And, you know, I have 6 siblings, and my mom was a single-parent bartender, so money was very tight and non-existent oftentimes. So we had a really weird childhood just because she worked so much. So she worked at the Shot Tower Inn in Dubuque, Iowa, as a bartender for decades. And some of you know that place, yeah. So, you know, she'd go to work, and she'd tell my older brothers to read to me. I have 4 older brothers, and they'd never read to me. Like, that was not part of the plan. So usually they'd tell me to put on, like, play football. It was a cue for me to go put on 3 sweatpants, 3 sweatshirts, and a football helmet. And then they'd sit on the couch and make me run through the doorway and shoot me with BB guns. So needless to say, I don't hunt. That was just like one thing. We'd climb up on the roof like on a nice day and rip off shingles and throw them as far as we could. I mean, just terrible stuff. As a homeowner now, I'm repulsed by our childhood. So then, you know, and you know, everybody knows poverty, and poverty comes in different ways. But, you know, for us, it would be like no heat, and we couldn't afford fuel oil. So all 8 of us would sleep in like the one room with the curtain up over the doorway where my brother shot me with BB guns. And then just to kind of stay warm in one room with the body heat and all that. Toilets didn't work, and then we couldn't afford a plumber because we needed to eat. So we just like dump the contents of the day in a black bag and run down around the neighborhood and throw it in sewers. We weren't very eco-friendly back then. But it's just, you know, it's just that kind of poverty. So, you know, when I was 7, I believe, let me think, 8 years old, I was watching TV with my mom, and Dan Gable won the Olympic gold. And she looked at me, she said, "Maybe someday that'll be you." And I tried out for the Olympics in 1984. It wasn't going to be me. I think my first 2 opponents thought I was like the mop for the mats, and pretty much took care of that my Olympic dreams. But I, you know, I went to school and tried to do well in school, and then wrestled in high school. I was, you know, probably above average wrestler, but by no means a blue chip or anything like that. I made it to state my senior year. And I won my first match in Des Moines, and then I lost my second one. And back then, if your guy lost after that, you were done, so I was done. And so then I decided I'm going to come to the University of Iowa. And I had brothers who were here during, like, when I was in high school, so I'd hitchhike down to see them. That's our mode of transportation when you don't have money. And so, it was typical to hitchhike. It sounds unique, but, I mean, my mom actually drove me to the edge of town that day, so I knew it was an important day, because usually she didn't do that. So, you know, I got there and I decided I wanted to try to walk on the wrestling team. And I wasn't like a slouch. I mean, not placing. There aren't probably many guys that wrestled Iowa that didn't place in high school. But so I was just kind of a scrappy, weird career kind of guy. And Dan Gable didn't know me from anybody. And he's sitting at the field house, the old field house, and he's in the middle of a workout. And I didn't realize you're not supposed to talk to him then because he was so uber focused that he was just weird. So then I walk up to him, he's sitting on a, I remember vividly, he was sweating real hard, and he's sitting on a, it was probably a summer like camp or something, because the mats were down on the field house floor. And he's just sitting there thinking about how he's going to destroy his opponent when he gets back in there, I'm sure. And he said, I said to him, Mr. Gable, I said, I'm Mitch Kelly and I'd like to be on your team. He kind of looks at me like, who are you and why are you talking to me right now? And then I said, he told me, well, he kind of felt me out a little bit and asked me some questions. And he said, get a physical and then come to practice and watch for a little bit, see if you want to be a part of that. So I did, and then I ended up being on the team. And, you know, there's 40 guys on the team that year, and I believe I was the 40th best, probably for sure. And then next year, a few people graduate, so then by attrition, you get a little bit better. And then, you know, new guys like me might come in. So I was like 37th. And third year, I was moved up to pretty far, like in the mid-20s. And then I got on scholarship. But, you know, it's a part scholarship sport, so it was a small scholarship, but a scholarship nonetheless. And then books, which was a good deal. So they paid for your college books. Back then, it wasn't like a month's worth salary. And then, you know, by junior, I think he let me, Mike Duro recruit me. He was a Northern Michigan coach, and he just passed away recently from brain cancer. But he was really good friends with Dan Gable. And Gable's like, you know, I don't know if this guy's going to hit my lineup, but, you know, he's a good wrestler. So I went up to Marquette, Michigan, and it took about 4.5 flights, it felt like, maybe 5, to get there. And I'm thinking, I'm never coming up here. But we had some good fishing while we were up there, and I like Mike Duro a lot. So then, you know, I got in the varsity lineup junior year, and then by senior year, I probably wrestled close to 20 matches. And my biggest thing was I was trying to beat out John Heffernan, who ended up being an All-American that year, at 158, because I couldn't beat his brother at 150, who was a national champion for us. I mean, I knew that because I'd wrestled him 3 times. So I think my record is 14-5 senior year, and 3 of my losses were to Jim Heffernan, my teammate. So I got third place at a lot of tournaments because he beat me in the semifinals, and then I worked my way back. So then, you know, I'm listening to the radio with my girlfriend, now wife, and I'm listening, and they're on the road, and Greg Randall pulls a hamstring. And I look at my girlfriend at the time and say, I wonder if I could cut down to 142 and get in the big meets. So I talked to Gabe when he got back. He said, if you make the weight, it's your weight. And so I'm like, okay, I'll make the weight. And I was student teaching at the time, so that was brutal. So I went to practice in the morning, work out to lose weight and sweat a lot. And then went and taught, and then came back regular practice, and then came back at 9 or 9:30 at night, and Gable put me through runs and all kinds of stuff, sauna. So I made the weight, and then I wrestled Okie State and had a really good match, and we won that meet. And I'm reading the newspaper and thinking I'm in the lineup, this would be awesome. And it goes through each match, like Des Moines Register predicting each match, it gets to my match and says toss-up, but whoever wins this match will probably win the meet. I did not need to hear that. So I'm like all nervous, and we had to weigh in early that back then, so I weighed 156 that night, I weighed at 142. And so I was ready to go, and I felt great. And it was on Iowa Public Television. Carver's mostly full, if not full. And I'm winning 10-1 going in the third period, just feeling great. And all of a sudden, I realize I'm exhausted. I have no energy. And I end up winning 15-11. And we won the meet 18-15. If I had lost, we would have lost that. So it was a pretty good way to go out. So I won my last college match. And then, you know, I went to grad school and worked for Gable. I gave a graduation speech for the College of Education. I knew Gable was going to be there because his daughter Annie was in the class. And I said, well, I see Dan Gable's here tonight. And everyone clapped, of course. And I said, we actually have a lot in common. We both have 4 children. We both work at the University of Iowa. We both live in the country. But the only big difference I can see is that I won my last college wrestling match. So that was good. I've used that one a few times. So, you know, Gable's been a great influence on my life, and I love the man. He just talked to my class last week. He comes every semester through the decades of my career. We go out and have a burger and cold beer afterwards. People always ask what it's like to wrestle Dan Gable, for Dan Gable. I liked wrestling for him a lot more than wrestling against him because that was not fun. So I'm going to flash forward just quickly to the next generation. So Dan Gable's in Carver Hawkeye Arena, and a new volleyball coach had been hired, Bon Szymanski. And Fran McCaffrey was a basketball coach. So I talked to Gable on the phone, and I don't think I've ever asked him to do something where he didn't do it. sometimes begrudgingly, but he usually ends up doing it. And I said, would you go talk to those coaches? I said, my daughter, you know, Molly's pretty good, dang good volleyball player. And my nephew, Nicholas Bear, is a pretty good basketball player. So he went and talked to both of them. It was kind of fun. But they both ended up MVP. Molly did senior year. And last year, Nicholas won the Chris Street Award. So Gable had an influence there, too. So that's all I got to say.
Storyteller Mitch Kelly. He is a clinical associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Iowa. And now our final storyteller of the hour takes us to the track. Jeremy Mims was born and raised in Iowa City, where he was a track star for City High School. He continued his track career into college and ran for 4 years at the University of Kansas. He's now a coach and mentor for three surrounding high schools across multiple sports, and he's finishing his MA in Sport and Recreation Management at the University of Iowa. Jeremy Mims.
So when I got done with high school, I was looking at colleges to go to and was getting recruited by a few different schools. And the school I ended up going to was the University of Kansas. And so I am a diehard Jayhawks fan through and through. So I went to Kansas, and the reason I went was simply because of the coach, Coach Stanley Redwine, who recruited me and who I knew cared about me more as an individual than as an athlete. And that showed. My freshman year, I came in, I didn't have a ton of success. I was not our best half miler. I improved a little bit, maybe, but not much better than I had been in high school. And my sophomore year, I had a breakout season, and I ended up making it to the national meet. And so I made it to nationals. I ran terribly. I was just excited to be there, but it was a great experience. My junior year was fraught with injuries. Some battles between coach and I. Every year I had a little blow up at some point, usually in the fall when there's a lot of training and you don't get to race, and so you get really frustrated. And at some point you just say, I don't want to do this anymore. And I would get upset about something, throw a tantrum, and coach would just let me walk away. And then I would come back and I'd slink into his office with my head down, and he'd be like, so you ready to go to practice? I'm like, yeah. So he just understood me. He understood when to get on my case, when to let me go, and just how to deal with me. And it was always about more than the sport. So my senior year comes around, and during the indoor season, we prepare, we get ready to go. We have a great indoor season. And I end up qualifying for the national meet. And in doing so, I end up breaking a 36-year-old record that had been set by Jim Ryan, who is, for those of you that don't know, is arguably the greatest mid-distance runner, American mid-distance runner of all time. First high schooler ever to break a 4-minute mile. And so this is a very prestigious record, huge Kansas guy, and I was fortunate enough to break that record. And it's all thanks to and all due to Coach Redwine. All I had to do was just run in circles. So we get ready for the outdoor season, and everything's going well. Training's going great. We make it to the regional meet. I qualify for the national meet, so we get to nationals. And I'm ranked fourth in the nation going into the national meet. And I remember getting ready for this race, and stepping on the line, and in that moment when I stepped on the line, I looked around at everyone else, and for some reason that moment I thought, what am I doing here? Like, I should not be here. I don't know if I'm ready for this. So the gun goes off, the race begins, and the first 200 meters we get out, I'm right in the middle of the pack. We get to 300 meters in the race. So for those of you that don't know, 800 meters is two laps around a track. All right, so 300 meters in. And I remember thinking to myself, I literally thought to myself, I don't think I can finish this race, because my adrenaline was gone. So I felt all this, I felt tired. I felt like I just couldn't do it. And I didn't think I could make it. That quickly goes away. It always does. And you get back into the race. And so we come through 400 meters and we go on the back straightaway. And as we're going down the back straightaway, there's this moment, and I always make a move with 300 meters to go. It's what I always do. It's when I put myself in position. It's how I've always raced. It's how coach expects me to race. And in that moment, I hesitated, and I didn't make the move that I usually do, because I questioned whether or not I could stick with everyone. And so as we went into the last 200 meters, we went around the turn. As we come off the turn, I go to try and make a big kick, and I try to swing out wide to go around the field. The problem is, because I didn't make my move early and get in front of some people, everyone widens out on the home straight. So I end up out in lane four, can't get around anyone, so I go back to lane one, which for any of you that know anything about track, you don't really want to change lanes when you don't have to. And I pass a few people on the inside, and I end up finishing fourth place. And so I finish up as an All-American. I run the best time I'd ever run in my life, 145.8. And right as soon as the race gets over, the winner, who's a good friend of mine from Nebraska, comes up to me and he says, "Mims, where were you?" And I said, "I made a couple mistakes." And he said, "Oh, I'm sprinting down the home straightaway. And I knew no one could beat me. But I thought you were going to run past me. You're the only one in the race that could beat me." And when he said it, he wasn't saying it to like rub it in or anything like that. But what it told me is that one of my friends and one of my competitors had more confidence in my ability in that race than what I had going into that race. And so we go up, and after you run the race, they put everyone on the stands and you get your medals. And so I got my medal. And as soon as I got my medal, I went and found our throws coach and the throwers. And I go and I hop in the van with the throwers, and I get a phone call from Coach Redwine. And he says, "Jeremy, where are you?" And I hadn't gone up and seen him after the race. And I go up to him after every single race. I always go up and find him. He's the first person I want to talk to. And I said, "I'm with the throwers." He's like, "Okay." So he doesn't say anything. Van takes us back to the hotel. I get dropped off. I walk in my room, my hotel room. My roommate's not there at the time. And as soon as that door closed behind me, I just break down and just start bawling. And in that race that is supposed to be this big race and all these accomplishments, I felt like I had let down everyone. I had let down my parents. I'd let down my friends. And I think in that moment, most importantly, I'd let down my teammates and my coach and my school. I don't think everyone understands what sports is in terms of how it builds a sense of community and how it can draw people in, and that, and how important that is for so many individuals. And for me, it was a huge part of why I ran, was not so much the social aspect, I guess it's that, but it was the being a part of something bigger than yourself, doing something for others. Every time I put that Kansas jersey on, I wasn't just running for me, I was running for an entire university, and most importantly, I was running for my teammates and my coach. And so forever, this race always pops up in my mind. When I think back on my entire career, it's really hard for me not to think about this one time, this one race that did not go as planned, this one race that did not go the way that I want it to. Out of all the successes that I've had, it's this one race that in my mind I still view very much, I view as a failure, while most people don't. And so now when I coach, What I try to do with my athletes is I try to help them feel as though they're a part of that same type of a community. That I don't want them to ever feel like they've let me down, because they can't. It's not possible. As long as they put in the effort and they try, they won't. Just like I know that in Coach Redwine's mind, I didn't let him down. I know I didn't let my teammates down or my family or my friends. But I want to make sure that my athletes feel connected every time they step on the track, or every time they come to a basketball practice, or every time they're at football practice, that they feel that they're a part of a community. And so I guess the reason I tell this story, or the whole reason I tell a story, is to talk about how important a coach is and how important my coach was, and to publicly say thank you to Coach Stanley Redwine.
Storyteller Jeremy Mims. You have been listening to Game Time, sports stories told in front of a live audience at Merge in downtown Iowa City on November 15th, sponsored by Iowa Watch, the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, and Iowa Public Radio. A huge thank you to the event management students at the University of Iowa for organizing the event. Technical support came from Jim Davies, and production from Caitlin Harrop. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.